on this episode of Optimal Health Uncovered.
The combination of too much belly fat and too little muscle is very much promoting of this insulin resistance thing, which is bad for cardiovascular health. And the way to reverse both of those things is not just to eat less caloric foods and you know, walk fast or run on a treadmill. For many people, you need to build more muscle mass because the muscles are an essential organ in the whole behind-the-scenes thing going on to reverse insulin resistance.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for another episode of Optimal Health Uncovered. I'm very excited to be here today to talk about a very important topic, and that is cardiovascular health, disease, injury, prevention. And we have a very special guest here, Dr. Alon Gittig from Mount Sinai. So you are a board-certified cardiologist here at Mount Sinai, as we discussed. After completing your undergraduate studies, where it all started at UPenn, you went on to get your doctorate degree at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. You then completed a residency in internal medicine at New York Presbyterian while Cornell. And last but definitely not least, at Montefiore Medical Center, you completed your cardiology fellowship. So we connected, I'd say, a couple months ago, and it was very interesting to reach out to a cardiologist that is as passionate as you are about the interventional piece, not specific only to medication and injured and diseased individuals, but on the preventative side. And we had a lot of synergy between just our thoughts around lifestyle, medicine, nutrition, exercise, management from that mechanism as well. So that's kind of what brought us to the podcast today. And I really appreciate your time and efforts in being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I was very excited as well when you reached out to me because, you know, as we'll talk about, I'm sure a big part of my journey has become really trying to drill down on what's happening and what's the root cause of it and how do we stop it. And that's not something you learn on that journey for all those degrees that you mentioned. You really have to learn it on your own. I think what you guys do for your patients is a huge piece of that. So.
Well, we are really passionate about finding like-minded individuals. So I was super excited when we met and so happy to be here today again. So what to start, I know we have the bio, but what led up to this? Why did you choose cardiology as a field? We'll start there.
So I would say, you know, going all the way back, I had a vague idea of what it meant to be a doctor and zero idea of what it meant to be a cardiologist. I didn't come from a family of people who were doctors in the family. We had some family friends, but you know, it was really just a sense for a lot of people have the same experience. You like helping people, you like science and biology. It seems like a good synthesis of the two interests. Along the way, you know, in medical school is really your first time that you kind of, if you don't have family members, you get a glimpse of what it's like to be a doctor. So when we finished with our first 2 years of studying the sciences in the classroom and we went onto the floors and did our rotations with doctors in the hospital, that's where it really clicked. And that was honestly the first time that I said, okay, this was the right decision. Because you really don't know before that. You get some sense. But when I was doing all of that, I found a lot of areas of medicine that I was exposed to interesting, but nothing really gripped me the way cardiology did. With cardiology, it's probably the number one most researched field in all of medicine, where you really can stand on just tons and tons of past studies and evidence to know what's happening, first of all, and you know the basic physiology of what's gone wrong and what medications and procedural treatments can improve that situation. So there's a lot of evidence there and I found it very compelling. And that's how I went into cardiology in the first place. And as I was doing my training in it, you know, the next step, cardiology fellowship, I really liked it. I mean, I had a really good experience. Yes, it's hard. You know, you spend nights on call not sleeping, but it was really interesting and it really compelled me to try to learn more. But I often found myself, you know, you're in the hospital, you're studying the sickest patients, right? And that's who you're helping. And that's understandable. That's by design, kind of how you have, how these, the programs are set up when you're training. But I often found myself just being struck by the fact that you'd see patients who this was their sixth or seventh or 10th stent being put in. And they were getting good care. They were getting, in some cases, perfect care according to the guidelines for how to diagnose and pharmacologically manage risk factors. Their cholesterol was excellent, blood pressure, et cetera. but it was so obvious. And this wasn't my own aha moment. I mean, you know, doctors, you speak to doctors, everyone kind of has this sense. You realize that there's big gaps. I mean, no matter how many medicines you throw to get the blood pressure and cholesterol down, nothing's happening to reduce their belly fat. Or in some cases, some of the medicines are causing side effects that are making it harder for them to lose weight. And I just found myself thinking more and more and more about what is the root cause? What's actually happening? Can we study it along the way? Is there some way to actually gain insight into whether or not someone's going in the right direction or the wrong direction, other than just looking at the surface manifestations of their risk factors? And that's kind of how I, you know, jumped into the deep end over the last 7 years or so.
Well, that's exciting. It's definitely needed and necessary. I mean, the statistics across the board of cardiovascular pathology and morbidity and mortality don't seem to necessarily get tremendously better, at least in this country. So we have a bunch of different topics, and you touched on a few already, you know, that body fat, that body composition is kind of being a central theme. So what is the relationship between body composition, fat deposition, lean body mass, and cardiovascular disease? Can we kind of unpack that a little bit as a starter?
Sure. And actually, you know, I would say that this is probably the most recent area of eye-opening for me. And it's also because with regards to the research on this topic and on musculoskeletal fitness, it's a relatively much younger area of research compared to cardio and aerobic exercise. So everybody on the street would tell you, yes, if you exercise, you're at low risk for heart disease. And they're picturing almost to a person, they're in their mind, their images of someone jogging or walking, you know, 30 minutes a day. And we've known for many years, there's tons of research showing the associations of being in better aerobic fitness with lower risks of heart disease, stroke. And by the way, we should mention dementia, cancers of several types, sepsis, pretty much you name it, everything that kills people in modern society. And some of that, obviously, if you're exercising regularly, it helps with weight loss or weight maintenance, and you're less likely to have a significant amount of body fat. But what's a newer area of research, relatively speaking, is that body composition can matter a lot, and that the benefits on body composition extend far beyond aerobic exercise, and that for many people, they actually can't achieve their goals unless they are engaging in some sort of resistance exercise program, not just to tone their muscles, but to build muscle, to hypertrophy muscle. So to answer this question, and I always try to, anytime I'm interviewed, I always try to say, I would love you to cut me off if it's getting too long, or if you have a question that you want to insert in that spot, because I'm very into trying to explain this for a layperson, and that often requires a lot of background explanation.
Sure.
But by all means, it would not offend me for you to cut me off.
No problem.
So from a general standpoint, a major issue with regards to body composition is abdominal fat tissue, right? So there's lots of things in our modern society that lead to us storing adipose tissue around our organs in our belly. And yes, some of that, you know, we all think of a beer gut. Okay, that's obvious. You have a beer belly. But many people hide a lot of fat stores in there. And you may only see it by subtle increases in measuring waist circumference. Sometimes your pants will tell you that, but a lot of the time that sits below this location in the abdomen. This is bad for two reasons. One is, it typically tells you you have what's called insulin resistance. And we can talk about that more and what it is. But suffice it to say for now, insulin resistance is what, if left untreated, will cause prediabetes and eventually diabetes. But for on average 10 years before it shows up as a blood sugar test, it is there in the background. But your blood sugar is able to be maintained normal by certain compensations in your body, but it leads to certain physiologic changes that increase cardiovascular risk. And one of the main signs that you have insulin resistance is that you're starting to store fat in your belly. So, that's problem number one. Problem number two is that from sometime in our 20s or so, once we get our first job, we wind up spending an inordinate amount of time seated and not moving. We stop playing, you know, pickup basketball like we did in college. And this goes on and on and on for years. And we rarely lift heavy objects. And so it is inevitable for most people in our modern society that their muscles are going to start to atrophy gradually. And some people have found that this is almost universal. As you get, if you're not lifting weights or doing some kind of a resistance exercise, starts almost universally somewhere in your 40s. So the combination of too much belly fat and too little muscle is very much promoting of this insulin resistance thing, which is bad for cardiovascular health. And the way to reverse both of those things is not just to eat less caloric foods and you know, walk fast or run on a treadmill. For many people, you need to build more muscle mass because the muscles are an essential organ in the whole behind the scenes thing going on to reverse insulin resistance.
Yeah, I think as we get into insulin resistance a little bit more, kind of a great segue into it here in a second, but I think the muscle component will come to light. For central obesity versus visceral fat, you know, central obesity, the adipose tissue pulling around the midsection, that's visible, that's obviously problematic. Is that different from visceral fat, which is inside and obviously hanging around the organs? Can we just break those out a little bit?
Right. So I guess there's two kind of dichotomous pictures of fat distribution. One is apple-shaped versus pear-shaped, right? So the pear-shaped is the adipose sits more around the buttocks, the thighs, and that's not as associated with risk as having it more in your midsection. But then when you're focused on the midsection, there are two places it can be. It can be subcutaneous. So you have a lot of fat buildup under the skin, but in the superficial tissues. Or it can be deeper than that within the abdominal cavity where it's coating the organs. You get fat stores around the liver, around the intestines. And so it's hard to know what you have just by an expanding waist circumference, because theoretically, if it's all superficial underneath the skin, it can still make your waist circumference expand. But statistically, if you have a big waist circumference, it's almost certainly that you have a significant amount of adipose tissue in the belly. The only way to really know that is with something called a DEXA scan, which is a type using x-rays to get a very accurate sense of how much of your body is muscle or bone or, you know, non-fat, and how much is fat. And of that fat, how much is in the abdominal cavity, which is generally what we refer to as visceral adiposity. Or VAT, visceral adipose tissue. Yeah.
So in DEXA scans, it's become more commonplace that people are presenting to our office with their DEXA information and looking to intervene, which is outstanding. In your practice, at what cadence would you be order? Is it standard practice that you're ordering a DEXA? If so, at what cadence? Because I know people, I think, somewhat overstate the radiation component of it. So I think that's something I wanted to just hash out, because we hear a lot of back and forth about that.
This is very evolving and very new. In my practice, it's not yet standard practice because, first of all, it's not covered by insurance for this purpose. So that's a whole separate conversation. In my practice, I do two things. I take care of many, many people who have insurance and want to use their insurance and are more interested in sort of doing whatever's covered by insurance. And I do my best to also push them on the things that insurance doesn't pay for, which is helping them get better lifestyle-wise. And then I have people who are extremely interested in personalized assessments to get as much information about their body as possible and to try to tweak every single thing that will maximize their chance of never getting artery disease in their lifetime. So in those patients, I tend to push further on things because they're willing to pay out of pocket for it. DEXA scans are very common in the world and covered by insurance to look for osteoporosis, so to look for bone mineral density. But to look for body composition, it's not covered. And most places that own the equipment to do a DEXA scan don't do that study. So there's really only a few places that you can go to and say, here's a prescription from my doctor for a DEXA scan. It's not that expensive from what I've been told by my patients. And the radiation really is very low. This is done with very high exposure radiation that is likely to get absorbed and cause problems. And you don't have to do it on a regular basis. In fact, it's unlikely you're going to see major changes in a short interval. I would say, you know, no matter how hard someone works, you're probably not going to see changes until close to 12 months or beyond. So, and you don't necessarily have to repeat it to see changes, although a lot of people want to because the proof is in the pudding with motivation. You know, it really pushes you to stick to things. But it is really the gold standard. Some people own, or some doctor's offices have, what's called a bioimpedance scale. It uses other technology to guesstimate it, but it's far less accurate and it's also more prone to artifacts related to your hydration status at the time.
Yeah. So I think the most, there's no financial disclosures for me, but the one that we hear about most commonly is InBody. That is one that is a bioelectrical impedance scale. It is validated compared to DEXA with decent statistics, but nothing is better than the DEXA. Hydrostatic weighing is another one, super inconvenient, not very accessible. Bod pods you can find maybe at local universities. That's just the air displacement, as where hydrostatic weighing is water displacement. And then the calipers, which again, not as accurate. But I think if you go just like range of motion for me as a physical therapist, if you're measuring, you know, against a common standard with the same individual, at least you can compare your test at point A to point B with calipers to that same individual if they're well-trained. Same thing with the bioelectrical impedance scale. If it's a decent device and you're doing it repetitively, while we can't validate it necessarily against the DEXA with huge statistics, you can at least say it hasn't changed drastically in terms of measurement error from point A to point B. So I think that's a good measuring stick throughout that 12-month period. I think how you feel, how you look, waist circumference measurements are important. I would encourage everyone who can do it to get a DEXA scan. I found it hugely important. I like to validate the results that we're getting with our training protocols, nutrition protocols. So I think it's hugely important. So it's been encouraging to see more common conversations about it. And you touched on every single question that I most commonly get. So I appreciate that.
We should say about the DEXA scan that it is going to give you the amount of the percentage of your body that's in the visceral adipose. It's going to tell you your percentile for people your age, which is critically important. Yeah. But it's also going to tell you the percentile of muscle mass in your arms and legs. So you're going to find out two critical pieces of information. Do you have more than optimal adipose tissue in your belly? And do you have less than optimal muscle? It is possible to have only one of those things. But especially if you have less than optimal muscle, then for sure part of your solution to shrink that adipose has to be building muscle. I also will say this. I love the idea of validating. For people who are concerned about the radiation or the repeat out of pocket, if they own or their doctor has a bioimpedance scale, measure the two together once. And if it's pretty close within reason to the DEXA, stick with that scale. If directionally it's going where you want it, you're in good shape. Yeah. The other thing I will say is that even without a DEXA scan, if you are not somebody who's been training in a resistance program of some sort, by the time you're in your 50s, the odds are very likely that you're starting to be low, you're under-muscled. And by the time you're in your 60s, even if you're a fit 60s who does yoga and everything else, if you're not lifting weights or doing some kind of very intense, intentional resistance, it's not everyone. But, you know, if you were blind and could not, you know, get a DEXA scan, you just had to go blindly at this, assume you're under-muscled.
Yeah.
It's a safe assumption.
Yeah, that appendicular, that arm and leg lean body mass and again shows that most people are under-muscled. It does become exponentially harder over the age of 60 to 65. It's never too late. Some people hear that and get a little bit discouraged. But, you know, if you're younger listening to this or you're older listening to this, it's never too late to try to either gain muscle or prevent wasting and sarcopenia. So I encourage everyone to continue to if you're continuing, meaning you're already on a program, continue it. If not, to start. So some good kind of layperson metrics in terms of not having a DEXA or even a bioelectrical impedance, which is accessible. And I would encourage even in an in-body scale, which you can find at most every GNC. So go to your local shopping center, go to your local mall, you can find that. So I would encourage people to be as data-driven as possible. But generally, if you're looking at your ability to get up and down from a chair, if you're looking at some of the longevity metrics, so are you under-muscled? This is not a perfect science, but the ability to do push-ups, as an example, the ability to get up and out of a chair, the ability to hang or do a pull-up, simple measures, grip strength is another thing with New York Times running this based on the New England Journal of Medicine article, I think, you know, 5+ years ago. So simple metrics of, can you carry stuff like a suitcase? Can you lift your groceries? Can you get up and down from a chair? All those are a measure of both mobility and strength, not perfect, but you know, if you're feeling like you are weaker, you most likely are. But most of the research regarding building lean body mass does require a little bit of a load that is above just the general ADL or activities of daily living. So it does require some type of resistance program. But there are some metrics and some science just looking kind of in your day-to-day life.
I just want to piggyback on that. We're talking about so far the way that body composition is important for how your arteries behave, things like insulin resistance, which can affect your artery behavior. And we're talking about how evaluating body composition and doing strength training can improve it. From just a sort of 30,000 foot view, it's also important to keep in mind that we have so many studies now looking at some of the things you just mentioned, get out of a chair and walk across a room, and grip strength for two that I know for sure there's a lot of studies, showing associations that are consistent in the same direction and similar magnitude with dying of all causes, dying of heart causes, being hospitalized for you name it, pneumonia, sepsis, et cetera, having serious complications after cardiac surgery or cardiac catheter-based procedures. The list goes on and on. Especially ending up living in a nursing home. So if you want the proof, you know, it's not a randomized trial and it never will be, but the associations are very strong for almost every health metric that is probably important to your listeners.
Yeah. Those correlatory studies with just basic life functions, based on strength, are important. I think the metric for pushups was less than 4, your cardiovascular or all-cause mortality would go up something like 90%. If you're over 10, it goes down by almost an equal measure. So it doesn't have to be lifting heavy, heavy things all the time, but just generally being active should help. But lean body mass is important. I like everyone to kind of get a baseline with that. So lean body mass kind of feeds into how our muscles can utilize glucose and some insulin sensitivity and resistance. So can you talk us through some of that? What is the relationship between insulin resistance and cardiovascular disease, operational definitions, wherever you'd like to start? Yeah, there?
Absolutely. This is super, super important. Let's start with this fact. When people have been admitted to the hospital for a heart attack or a stroke, and they have done blood work to look for obvious signs of insulin resistance, we're talking pre-diabetes or diabetes. We're not talking more subtle forms, which we can get into. Between 60 and 70% of people have that who did not already carry the diagnosis. So these are people who either their doctor didn't pick up on it earlier, which it was there, it just wasn't looked at or discussed, or the patient wasn't aware. So we know that this is a very, very common, let's say it goes along with it, whether it caused it or not, we don't know. There are lots of things that go on in the body when someone has insulin resistance that would be likely causal, okay? So the basic way of thinking about insulin resistance in general is all of us have a pancreas. Our pancreas makes insulin under certain conditions. Insulin binds to receptors on cells of different organs in our body. And depending on what organ it is, it tells it to do this. This tells the cells to do different things. There are a cascade of events that follow the binding to that receptor. When you are having insulin resistance, it means that when the insulin binds to its receptor, the measurable downstream effects are less. They don't stop altogether, but they are less. They at first are a little less, and with time, it gets worse and worse and worse. So the most common manifestation of this, and the one that's most intuitive to people, has to do with blood sugar. Okay, insulin controls blood sugar. So the basic paradigm of how that works is you eat something that has carbs in it. They get broken down into sugars. The sugar in your blood, the glucose level, starts to rise. Your pancreas immediately senses that and secretes a squirt of insulin into the bloodstream. The insulin binds to a handful of receptors on a handful of muscle cells. It then creates a cascade of events that causes the muscles to very actively suck up glucose out of the blood into the muscle cells. And then once it's in the muscles use it or store it. But that's how you maintain your blood sugar level. For the most part, the vast majority of the heavy lifting, pun intended, is the muscle cells. Okay. So over time, let's say when you're 18 years old, you're, you know, in great shape, you're jogging every day, whatever it is, you don't have a lot of mental stress. You haven't had insomnia yet. All the modern plagues of modern living. Your pancreas makes a few insulin molecules to do the job, and they bind to a handful of receptors, and it's gorgeous. Your muscles just immediately respond and soak up the glucose, and there's no measurable rise in your blood sugar. Once you start becoming insulin resistant, the pancreas can sense it very subtly, and it starts making more insulin when it needs to lower the blood sugar. It senses that the blood sugar doesn't drop as quickly and may not drop to as perfect a level in response to that little squirt of insulin. And so it needs to put out more to bind more available receptors. Okay. And so for a long time, you can keep the blood sugar stable if you are just putting out more and more insulin to saturate until all the receptors are saturated. And eventually, if the response that the muscle cells give to the binding of insulin to the receptors on their cells gets so blunted that once every single cell's receptors are saturated by a maximum amount of insulin that your pancreas can make, or your pancreas can't make enough anymore because it's maxed out, that's when the blood sugar will start to rise. And the important thing to understand is that on average, that process takes 10 years till you see the blood sugar rise to the part that it gets flagged as abnormal. We're talking about a hemoglobin A1C, which is the best we have, until it gets flagged as abnormal. So it goes on for a long time. Okay, so that's the basic concept of insulin resistance as it relates to blood sugar. You can also have insulin resistance in your fat cells in the belly. You can have it in your liver. You can have it in your brain. So this can affect a lot of areas of health, okay? Insulin resistance is felt to probably be causal in artery disease because when you have that state, it's a double whammy. Your blood sugar, eventually, as it gets progressively worse, your blood sugar will go too high. It'll go higher than we were originally designed to go. That's bad. Bathing tissues in high level of blood sugar over and over again is not a good thing. But the other thing is every time the glucose spikes, the insulin will spike because your pancreas is trying to protect the blood levels to keep them within a certain range. High level of insulin exposure to tissues is a bad thing. So you're getting two things that promote cell growth in abnormal ways, hence hyperplasia in the artery walls, hence cancer risk, can promote inflammation, hence artery disease, clotting, dementia, et cetera. So there's a lot of things that go along with it. So I think I'll stop there for a second because that sort of paints the picture.
Yeah.
And then my next thing is usually to talk about how you optimize it with that paradigm in mind. But you let me know.
No, you're doing, this is fantastic. I have limited questions because you're covering most everything. One thing that came to mind with that 10-year time where it could take HbA1c to be off track, what are markers of insulin resistance along the way, if any, that we can do so we can intervene earlier on?
Yeah, no, we can check and we do and we must, and I do it every single day. So the gold standard to know if you have insulin resistance, first of all, I should say it's, I told you that there's two things really that can be measured that'll tell you. It's the blood sugar levels and the insulin levels. Insulin is harder to measure than blood sugar. So, you know, we do finger sticks, people do, to see what happens to their glucose after they eat. If it goes up real high, you have insulin resistance because you're not able to manage that glucose response to insulin. It's harder to measure insulin outside of a lab setting. The gold standard to diagnose insulin resistance, as well as, by the way, the gold standard to diagnose prediabetes or diabetes, is the glucose tolerance test. Right. Which most people have heard about because it's done for screening pregnant women who are at risk for gestational diabetes. It's not it's an artificial phenomenon, meaning you go into a lab and they give you an intensely sugary drink, and then that stimulates a major insulin response from your pancreas to keep the blood sugar levels normal. And they are measuring what happens to your glucose levels at various time intervals after that. And we have cutoffs of what's normal and what's abnormal. That has been validated as the best predictor of who will go on. First of all, you make the diagnosis of gestational diabetes based on that in a pregnant woman. And in everyone else, it's the best predictor of who will go on to develop diabetes over the course of a 7-year time frame. It's laborious. Not that bad, but especially for our listeners, requires 2 to 3 hours going into a lab and time for the phlebotomist. And a lot of people, until they're explained why it's important, don't want to do it. And certainly you can't just do it right on the spot and get the answer the next day in your doctor's office. So because of that, the American Diabetes Association and other people have tried to come up with measurements of just a one-off glucose level, as well as a HbA1c, hemoglobin A1c, to make these diagnoses. The spontaneous glucose level, I consider just, unless it's through the roof astronomically high, not useful, because most people are in a borderline range, either high normal range or just over normal. it's so dynamic. I mean, when people wear a continuous glucose monitor, you see that, you know, they get cut off in traffic and their stress level goes up and their cortisol production goes up, their glucose rises. So it, you have a bad night's sleep or you're in traffic on the way to the lab and you're rushing, you can have a high glucose. It doesn't tell you anything. The hemoglobin A1C is much better because it's much more stable. It's measuring, it's inferring glucose over a 3-month period. It's looking at the amount of glucose that has become bound to the hemoglobin molecule in your red blood cells. And that is something that happens over time in proportion to how high your blood sugar levels are. When they're high enough for a certain amount of time, there's a chemical reaction where they bind to hemoglobin. So it generally correlates. And you can infer an average glucose reading over the last 3 months. Why 3 months? That's the average lifespan of red blood cells in your body. So they've been exposed for 3 months to the glucose levels, and that's resulting in X percentage that have been glycated, hemoglobin A1C. The issue there is it's imperfect. It's certainly good at the extremely high levels, but studies have shown that many people have pre-diabetes where their hemoglobin A1C is still in the normal range. And a non-trivial amount, which I was shocked to find out recently, can have diabetes when they're looking just borderline on the A1C, or can actually have an A1C that looks like pre-diabetes and they're normal on a glucose tolerance test. That's less common, but it does happen. So, you know, we try to simplify things in medicine. It makes sense. You do the hemoglobin A1C, you get a quick answer, but there are some people that it's going to be inaccurate. And for people who really want to know, and I think if your goal is to live into your 90s and be able to do a lot of things that are consistent with optimal health, you should know. But there are some other very important clues. So one thing is what goes along with insulin resistance. If you're a person, like I see, you know, every few weeks, who says, my blood pressure is always 90 over 60. I don't understand why now all of a sudden it's 120. I know it's normal, but it's high for me. A lot of times that's a sign of insulin resistance. Your belly's getting bigger and you're having trouble losing the weight despite really doing a lot of things that are known to be healthy. That's an important sign of insulin resistance. So those are like the more common sort of phenotypic eyeball test things. On labs, some important things. First of all, high triglycerides, very, very common sign of insulin resistance. It can be caused by genetics, but especially if your triglycerides have gone up and are now elevated or significantly more elevated, very common. And in my opinion, you know, basically there are a few other things that can do it, but if somebody has high triglycerides, the vast majority have insulin resistance. You should assume it until proven otherwise. You also can look at the ratio of your triglycerides to your HDL cholesterol measurement. When that ratio is 3 or above, very, very high incidence of insulin resistance. And even at 2.5, it's pretty likely. Some people get these cholesterol measurements done that look at particle size. We could do an hour podcast on that. But if you have high levels of small LDL particles, high numbers of small LDL particles, especially because there's some genetic influence on that, if that wasn't the case on previous tests and now it is, there's some research that shows that that finding actually might be the earliest indicator of insulin resistance because insulin resistance for a number of possible reasons has a lot of effects on how LDL particles are composed. Uric acid often goes along with insulin resistance. So if your uric acid is high, definitely be thoughtful about it. But even if it's not high, if it's starting to trend up, and I would say once you're getting into the sixes and certainly sevens range, which is considered normal on labs, you should be thinking about insulin resistance. Fasting insulin can be helpful. If I ate a meal with some carbs in it for dinner, or I had a snack, my insulin will go up appropriately after I eat. If I have insulin resistance, the insulin will go up even more because remember we talked about you have to saturate more receptors. By the time you've completed an 8-hour fast and you go in for fasting blood work in the morning, the level should be way down. If the level is over 10, and by the way, it's not going to be flagged on the lab report. That's not what that test was designed for. But if it's over 10, it's very likely you have insulin resistance. And the other thing is look at your hemoglobin A1C, okay? If you've had prior values, and it's often not tested for unless there's like obesity or some other signs of insulin resistance, if it's been tested for and it's going up by 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, think about it. And by the time you get to the highest level of the normal range, an A1C of 5.6%. In my experience, when we do glucose tolerance tests, the majority are insulin resistant at that point.
All right. So just to put a bow on that, because that was extremely thorough, but I want to make sure I am not getting lost and hopefully the listeners aren't getting lost. Best case, from a blood panel, HbA1c, fasting insulin, fasting glucose, glucose tolerance test in addition, anything that would be missing there? Well, what would be missing there would be LDLs, and I think we'll get into that aspect. If there's a history of familial hypercholesterolemia, if I'm understanding, like certain particle size, whether it be VLDL, is probably important with insulin resistance. So we can get into
that.
I
would say triglycerides and triglycerides. HDL ratio is the most important.
Okay. All right. So that'd kind of be your panel there in the hands of a skilled expert. Trying to now have some positivity on this. What do we do about insulin resistance once it's identified? Sure. What's the most logical interventional path, pharmacologically or otherwise?
Right. So we'll get to the good news. The bad news is 15% of U.S. adults have diabetes and about 30% have prediabetes. Those numbers are rough. And remember, I just said we're not measuring that with the gold standard. So they're missing some and they're overcounting some. But it's a pretty good estimate, especially when we look at the rates of overweight and obesity. But remember, you're insulin resistant on average for 10 years before you have prediabetes. So I've seen estimates that between 70 and 80% of U.S. adults have insulin resistance. So basically, I would say everybody who is interested in longevity and wellness needs to think hard about this and think with a doctor hard about whether you have it. What causes it? Well, there's a lot of different things that can cause it, and usually there's more than one contributing. So first of all, genetics is huge. I mean, if somebody has a family history of adult onset diabetes in a couple of people, they very likely could have genetics that are at play. The most common reasons, and it's all lifestyle, is inactivity, lack of cardio exercise, being under-muscled, lack of resistance exercise. By the way, we have very strong evidence with the most sophisticated tools that actually measure what happens in your muscle cells when insulin binds to the receptor, showing that there is a marked increase in that response after 40 minutes of moderate intensity exercise. So if you're riding a bike fast enough that your breath is a little off when you try to speak and you can't have a normal sentence or two, you do that for 30, 40 minutes, you're improving your muscle insulin resistance on the spot.
Which is, that's a good marker of zone two cardio for anyone who's into zone training. So going without fancy tools or devices to get your max heart rate, you can go a percentage, but Absolutely. Usually a touch beyond a conversational exercise capacity probably puts you into zone two. You could have a conversation. It would be pretty challenging. Generally, that's a good rule of thumb that I've heard that I try to abide by 4 to 5 days a week, ideal situation, 2 to 3 bare minimum. 45, 50 minutes at that zone and that intensity.
I would add, I am not at all a fan of heart rate. I don't think it correlates well with what's happening with your VO2 max, which is the ultimate measure, as you know, of metabolic activity. But I would say that a lot of the time you can carry on a conversation. It's just, you won't sound the same.
Yeah.
You won't high intensity. You're going to have to stop to catch your breath. You probably won't have to stop to catch your breath with one or two sentences. You will, if you try to say more, but it will be obvious that there's a breath in there. You can't hold back. So those two things are critical. The, diets that are high in refined sugars, refined carbs. So that's anything with added sugars, and I don't care what they call it, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or rice syrup or cane syrup, but also flour from grains, from wheat. When you eat wheat flour, it gets converted very quickly into sugar in your sugar in your body. So diets, those are very much associated with the likelihood of having insulin resistance, okay? Being overweight, especially in your midsection. We didn't get to this before, but the abdominal adiposity, I said there were two reasons it was bad. One is because it's an indicator you have insulin resistance until proven otherwise. And two is because then it takes on a life of its own. And the cells that make up the fat cells in the belly behave differently than fat cells in your thighs. And they secrete things that likely worsen insulin resistance. But the reason why this gets to you, you can tell right now why a lot of people have it. But the reason we get to that point where 80% of adults have it is because if you throw in high mental stress, dysregulated chronic mental stress, even when it's not overwhelming, you know, acute disasters, but it's just always there in and out on work, et cetera, and insomnia, sleep disturbance, which can, you know, in some studies affects 30% of people. these things promote dysregulated cortisol throughout the day so that your overall exposure to cortisol in your body is higher than normal. Cortisol blocks the effects of insulin and promotes insulin resistance. So those are the main causes. The positive about all this is that it's all reversible, completely reversible. And yes, there are medications that lower blood sugar. And yes, some of those medications do so by acting in a way that makes people less insulin resistant, which is an important thing. But if you can increase your cardio, if you can increase your strength training, build muscle, if you can work on stress management, improve your sleep, not with Ambien, and you can, you know, cut down on the simple sugars and the refined grains in your diet, even if you do two of those things, you're very likely going to improve the situation. But if you really take it on, you're going to reverse it. And people can reverse this. And it's the usual that it will get reversed if you're very serious and take on everything.
Yeah. I'm glad you touched on sleep. I know Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. He touched on a series of studies that looked at, I think, a week's worth of maybe deposition of sleep for 4 to 5 hours max people were getting for a period of 4 to 5 days. And there was a decrease by 50% in glucose disposal in the muscles. So there's your insulin resistance right there.
Absolutely.
So lifestyle modifications, exercise, eating well, gaining muscle mass, decreasing body fat, good mix of cardiovascular and resistance training, sleeping well, stress. We talked about stress and traffic, and anyone who's wore a CGM can see stressful situations, the glucose spikes, cortisol levels affecting glucose and glucose disposal as well. So just living generally a healthy lifestyle, easier said than done at times. You know, our 18-year-old selves were a little bit different from the life stresses now. But I think the silver lining of it all is it is reversible. Of all the diseases that we have that are not reversible, that you can't do a lot about except treat and manage, a lot of these disorders, if you get to it early, are treatable, with effort. And that to me is always the highlight and where I love to be able to intervene with individuals that are coming through our doors.
Two last thoughts on this.
Sure.
One, which is sort of a summary that is a take-home point. I think I've said it either in this way or in fragments, but I want to make sure I say it. Insulin resistance is associated with basically everything that we are all going to likely die from. So if you look at cardiovascular disease, the number one killer, if you look at cancer, the number two killer in closing fast, and if you look at dementia, okay, those three are basically it for the vast majority of people in modern society. Insulin resistance is associated with significant portions of the burden of risk of those diseases. So those diseases are therefore preventable in large part by optimizing this. Take home message I want everyone to remember. Yeah. The other thing, just to add on quickly, it's a little pearl, but we mentioned sleep. What we didn't talk about is sleep apnea. Without getting into it in detail, even if you feel refreshed and you're asleep in bed for 8 hours a night, if you are somebody who is having these asymptomatic sleep apnea episodes, there's a lot of evidence that links that to insulin resistance. And in some people who are doing everything right and their numbers are being stubborn, there's correlative data that shows that the people who have sleep apnea and treat it with a mask at night have a much higher likelihood of improving their hemoglobin A1C over the next year.
Wow.
So important to keep that in mind.
So we can go on and on, but we'll stop for time's sake. I think there's so much to unpack even from this podcast, plus potential options that I'm thinking in my head for future ones. I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for joining us. For anyone who's listening, is there any way for people to access you, find you, whether it be your practice, any social media, et cetera, anything that you'd want to highlight?
So if people want to find me and talk more about these topics, I'm happy to do so. I do practice in Westchester. I'm at Mount Sinai Doctors Westchester. I have an office in Scarsdale and in Yonkers. Our website is on mountsinai.org. You can search by location and look for Mount Sinai Doctors Westchester. And it'll give you our office contact information there. I do in-person and telehealth visits. And, you know, these types of topics are very amenable to telehealth visits. And I'm on LinkedIn. I haven't gotten the bandwidth yet where I can manage multiple social media accounts, but I do a lot of posts on LinkedIn related to this and similar topics.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us here. And everyone for listening, thank you for another episode. And we look forward to having you next time.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks.